From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2003 when the Center for Court Innovation conducted a study of 6 drug courts in New York State. The idea behind drug courts was simple but still rather new at the time. Instead of incarcerating and simply criminalizing in strict terms, courts would look at new ways to handle drug offenders. That's because the old system wasn't really working. Rates of recidivism were very high, which meant that months or years of incarceration were not curing drug problems. Lives and tax dollars were often wasted. That study demonstrated that with the drug court model, rates of recidivism dropped significantly. New York State moved to expand the drug court system, and as of August 1st, 2014, there are now 146 drug courts in operation in this state. This hour, we continue our look at the impact of the heroin and the opioid epidemic. What can be done about it? What are we seeing locally? We're going to have a wide-ranging discussion this hour, and we're going to start with the question of how drug courts are handling it and how often we see it there. Michelle Faust, my colleague in studio with us. Nice to see you again,
Hi.
Of course. And let me bring in Elizabeth Burick, who is a coordinator with the Rochester Drug Treatment Court, who's on the line with us. Elizabeth, thanks for taking the time for us.
Oh, no problem. I'm happy to be here.
How many people does drug court work with either at any one time or on an annual basis, Elizabeth?
Well, on an annual basis, we see anywhere from 500 to 600 defendants per year. We currently have in all of our treatment court programs about 800 defendants right now.
And I did my best. We've covered this sort of over the years in Rochester, but how would you describe in a shorthand way the mission of the drug court model?
Let's see. Drug courts are a tough and therapeutic approach at the same time. They provide the most intensive supervision of any defendant who's not incarcerated and out in the community. So drug courts provide a helping hand to addicted offenders, essentially who've hit rock bottom and are otherwise going to jail.
And of all of the people you work with on an annual basis, any idea how it breaks down now? How many are there for heroin or opioids?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because when I first started working in this field, cocaine was the big trend. But as of the last 5 to 6 years, we've seen an increase in opiate and heroin addiction, and that right now is our leading drug of choice that our defendants are using.
So it is the leading one, and
it's the leading drug that all of our defendants are using.
Wow.
So it's the most used. So if we ask a defendant, you know, what they're using, we see 80% of the time that the drug of choice that they're saying that they want to use is opiates or heroin.
And you're seeing that quite a bit. It goes along the models of the numbers that we're looking at of people being addicted going into treatment and people who are dying of overdoses. So
correct.
It's all related to opioid use. Now, what are the reasons that people are coming into drug court? What are some of the typical crimes, and then how do you follow through with those people?
Well, and there could be any type of crime. We see felonies and misdemeanors. They're nonviolent offenders. So these are folks that can be supervised out in the community, and they can commit anything from some type of petty larceny, some type of burglary, a fraud, possession charges. We often see some DWIs. So anything like that, that's what we call is an addiction-driven crime. So if we look at the defendant and we know that a lot of these crimes are crimes that the defendants are occurring or creating or doing because they are addicted to either heroin or opiates, we know that it's related to that.
So it sounds like it's trying to get to the root of the problem instead of just dealing with just...
Right, correct. So essentially what the drug courts do is not only address the crime, but we also address the addiction.
Now, when we spoke before, you said this is leads to a lot of savings because otherwise these people would be incarcerated.
Absolutely. So if you look at the either local or national prison costs, we know that, you know, it costs about $1 a day to put someone in treatment, whereas it could cost up to $10 a day to incarcerate an individual. And that, you know, it just depends on your jurisdiction. But we know that it's a huge savings to have somebody back in the community and not in jail.
So what's a typical contract look like for someone who's coming into drug court?
So the defendant comes into drug court, and it's an optional program. And so what they do is they waive their right to trial. They come in and they agree to participate in a treatment program, stay clean and sober for a minimum of 12 months. If they don't have a job, they have to have a job before they can complete it. And if they don't have a high school diploma or a GED, they have to get the GED or high school diploma before they leave our program. So once you see somebody who's completing the drug court, they are clean and sober, they're employed, and they have a high school diploma. So they come in essentially without those things, and they leave with those things.
And do you see any difference in the way that we approach drug court here in Monroe County as opposed to other places in the country?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, you know, Monroe County has always been on the cutting edge of having drug courts within their community and rapidly expanding. You know, and other states aren't so lucky to have, you know, these courts institutionalized. In New York State, drug courts became institutionalized early on.
And this is making an impact on the recidivism rates, people coming back. You said you've done some studies on that.
Oh, yeah, of course, you know, because drug courts are, and, you know, anybody who's looked at them know that they're the most studied and researched diversion program out there in the community because they, you know, because they're so highly recognized. And so what the trends are saying and what we found is the national average is anyone who's arrested, within 1 year, 60%, at 60% of the time, that person will be rearrested, okay? And we know that with someone who's entering the drug court program, that is cut in half. So we know that if somebody comes into the drug court program, they're only likely to get arrested within, you know, a 30% recidivism rate.
Elizabeth, before we let you go, we're talking to Elizabeth Burek, who is a coordinator with the Rochester Drug Treatment Court. A little bit of an offbeat question, but Brian online asked a question that I kind of was curious about, and it's not exactly related to heroin or opioids, but he's curious to know how many people in drug court are there for addiction to marijuana. Do we know?
Well, you know, sometimes addiction to marijuana seems to be the underlying issue, and what we see is that addiction to marijuana is usually kind of, we call it the gateway drug. So we see this trend where individuals will start by using marijuana, and that doesn't necessarily get them into trouble with the criminal justice system. But then once they trend to using more and more drugs, they often turn to more effective or a higher dose of a drug. So we see quite a few folks who are using marijuana and addicted to marijuana, but mostly it is heroin and opiates.
Okay, and so for those who do not transition to other drugs from marijuana, they're rarely in drug treatment court.
Correct.
Okay. And then just the last brief question, I'll let you go because I know you got to get out of here.
Yeah, we actually have court today.
All right. The last question would be just to make sure we understand, every drug is different. Every person is a little different. What are there unique challenges for people who are addicted to heroin and opioids? And, you know, do you feel like over the years you've gotten more effective at sort of handling those kind of cases, the more you see of them?
I think so. You know, and heroin is definitely a large problem and a big problem within this community. But I think that the medical society and doctors and professionals who are treating these folks out in the community have stayed current with all types of medications and all types of treatment modalities. And that's really helped us to you know, work with defendants who are addicted to opiates out in the community. And we really rely on the experts within the city of Rochester and the county of Monroe who are treating these individuals and caring for these individuals and reporting back to us. But yes, there is a unique need. They are treated differently and they respond to treatment differently. But we have great treatment professionals out in the community who take care of that.
Elizabeth, thanks for the time. And I will say for our listeners, she's a coordinator with the Rochester Drug Treatment Court. I have spoken to judges and coordinators in rural areas, in more conservative areas. There's almost uniform agreement that this is at least an opportunity that should be explored. And it has been fascinating to see over the years just the way this state has embraced the model. So thanks for taking the time,
Great.
Elizabeth.
No problem. Thanks.
Elizabeth Burek with the Rochester Drug Treatment Court. Now, let me introduce our guests in studio for the remainder of the hour. Dr. Timothy Wiegand is here. He's the director of toxicology for the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Wiegand, nice to have you here.
Thank you, Evan.
Also here is Alinda Ford. She is the manager of the Harm Reduction Initiative at Trillium Health. Alinda, nice to see you.
Nice to meet you.
And also here is Heather White. She's an RN at Trillium. Nice to see you. And the one rule for our guests is we're all going to get nice and close to our microphones for the rest of the hour. We're all going to get nice and snuggly with mics as we talk about these among various issues. I met Dr. Wiegand a number of years ago and we covered other drug issues. We had talked about bath salts and some other trends that were going on at the time. And Dr. Wiegand, what have you seen as a director of toxicology? You just heard Elizabeth Burek from the Rochester Drug Treatment Court say that opioids and heroin are roughly 80% of their cases, and it's far and away number one as an issue when that did not used to be the case. What have you seen?
Well, the opiates or the opioids are the most lethal drugs out there. When in 2009 across the U.S., accidental overdose became the number one cause of accidental injury and as a cause of death. And the reason for that was because prescription opiates were prescribed so prevalently. The rising rates of prescription for pain medications, the opiates have increased exponentially over the last 10 years. And on the heels of the prescription opiates, heroin has come into place because it's cheaper, more readily available. The prescription opiates, people have started to monitor a little bit more appropriately and look for alternative ways of treating individuals, and heroin has been readily available as people have stepped in. The opiates affect the body and the ability to breathe. They dampen the respiratory drive, or when somebody's trying to breathe or the brain is taking a breath, it dampens that ability down a little bit. And as you increase the dose, that goes away entirely. So when you have a drug that blocks people's ability to breathe, when you take an overdose of that, the toxicity is a fatality. So the opiates and heroin are the number one cause of the drug-related fatalities.
If you want to call the program with questions or comments this hour, and I already see the phone ringing, we're going to be getting to your comments and questions with our panel as we talk about heroin, opioids, addiction, and issues here in the Rochester, Finger Lakes, and Western New York region. You can call. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Before I jump on the phones, I'll kick it over to my colleague Michelle Faust, because I know you've been covering this from so many different angles over the recent weeks here. So go ahead, Michelle, and in a moment we'll start taking some of your phone calls.
Well, I would really like to encourage all of our listeners to go to WXXINews.org and click on the link Heroin at Home. You'll find this program there. You'll hear Need to Know. You'll be able to watch the Need to Know from Thursday, as well as the other reporting that we're doing around this. Now, to our Trillium compatriots who are here, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about an issue that we're not really seeing here in Rochester, but something that was happening this year in Indiana, and especially Indiana and Kentucky, an outbreak of HIV, AIDS, Hep C, and it's all related to people intravenous drug use, heroin use. And people, they're just starting to do what we've been doing here in Rochester for a while and have a needle
years.
Exchange. Talk to us a little bit about that needle exchange program that we have here and some of the effect that it's had as far as curtailing the number of people who are getting exposed to HIV, Hep C.
Trillium Health's outreach project, it consists of the syringe exchange program and the expanded syringe access program. Both of those programs provide clean syringes, sterile syringes, and harm reduction tools for injection drug users. We've been around for just a little over 20 years now, and If you look at some of the studies that New York State has done, it shows that in individuals who become HIV or incidents of HIV positive injection drug users have decreased from 52% back in 1992. These are attributable to the injection drug use, that it has decreased to less than 3% for new HIV cases in 2012.
So we're seeing
for the injection
results.
Drug uses, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Heather White, talk to us about, you know, that the trends and the what are we seeing as far as people coming in with this heroin and opioid abuse epidemic, that people are calling it an epidemic. What does that mean in your practice?
Well, I've been working at Trillium Health for about 8 years, and when I started, it was an older urban population that had HIV and hepatitis C. Now I'm seeing young suburban middle-class kids who started out on opiates, painkillers, and found that it was cheaper to go and get heroin, and that's what I'm seeing come through the doors
now. And that's how they contracted the disease.
I have a lot of new hepatitis C positive kids in their teens and 20s when they contracted it.
Well, let's go ahead and get some of your phone calls. I know Robert's been waiting for a while, and again, we can try to address this from a number of angles with our panel as we talk about heroin, opiates, and related issues. And Robert in Rochester, go ahead.
Step seven, there's 2 points. One,
sure.
From my own personal experience, we had a friend of ours, their son was in high school, suffered a sports injury, had knee surgery, and they prescribed him a bunch of painkillers. Well, he became addicted to those, and eventually it led to heroin, and he actually died of an overdose. So when I went in for minor surgery last summer, it's going to be worthy of extended painkillers, and they tried to give me 40 hydrocodone, and they said I only wanted 2 days worth. And there's nothing I could do to dissuade them from giving me a huge bottle of these pills. I took the bottle. Eventually, all I wanted was six pills. I took the six for 2 days and threw the rest out. So I do think there's still over-prescription and a lack of seriousness on the doctor's part of letting people understand it's okay to be in a little bit of pain. I mean, people want to have a procedure and to be completely comfortable the entire time. It's just not possible to have a nice balance like that. I think parents should be warned, especially with kids. The other one is the biggest point I have. I feel that the schools are not doing a good enough job of educating the parents and the children on a regular basis of the seriousness of the heroin and opiate problem. I'll give you a perfect example. 2010, I was told by a tenured teacher who I had known since I went to Runcote High School back in the 70s. He was still teaching there part-time. He told me he was absolutely alarmed, and I said, what was it? He says, there's this heroin problem, this new heroin problem in the middle and the high school. And I asked him to tell me about it. He said, it's nothing like you've seen before. It turns out it was the high-grade heroin that was coming in, the 80% pure type heroin, where the kids will sniff it or smoke it versus the old days they had to go to the needle right away. And I went to the sheriff's and actually asked him if they would bring in the drug dogs. He had the emails. He said, sure, we'll bring him in for free. He said, I'll contact the school and we'll come in, like Fairport will let us in, and we'll contact West Runcote and they'll let us in. So he called and contacted the school board and the superintendent, and they flatly refused his offer. And I went to the school board and quietly asked them, like, you don't understand this. I was told by this teacher how serious this problem is. And what people don't understand, I hear you talking about treatment. The sheriff told me the success rate is horrible on rehab. Most of these kids end up dead, he said. He said a 5 or 10% success, and that's after parents sell their home and mortgage everything to pay for it. So I think people should understand this idea of treatment is a misnomer. And I'll go on to say, not only did they deny they had a problem, even though their own school survey had 2% kids actually admitting they were doing heroin, but they went ahead and said it was all nonsense and went on TV and said they didn't have a problem. And I found out just a few days after that interview with Channel 13, after the school board president, Charles Perot, said he didn't have a problem. They had just expelled the kid 5 days earlier for dealing heroin in Runcote High School. I know the kid's name. I would not say it on air.
Well,
but I'm telling you, the level of denial and the level of proactive action on the part of the school board, dealing directly with the parents, because the only real answer to this is education. And I don't think kids still to this day have an idea or inkling of the seriousness and the gravity of this. You tried a few times, it basically finishes what the sheriff told me.
Robert, please hang
with this regularly.
Stay on the line because you've given us a lot, and I want to work backwards there. And I want to start with, because again, to some degree, I think I want to be careful. I'm not dismissing at all what you're saying about the schools. It's tough they're not here to kind of talk about their own position, but I do think it's an important part of this discussion. So let me work backwards. And
I have the emails too. So.
Sure, sure. And I want to start with Dr. Wiegand, and we'll ask the panel. He's saying that he's very concerned about what he's hearing about the success rates, that the success rates are very low, and that this is a very, very dangerous issue. Dr. Wiegand, first of all?
Well, I appreciate the comments. First, treatment does work. We don't have enough treatment. We don't have enough slots. And then you have to look at what types of treatment are available. We don't have enough providers willing to prescribe buprenorphine. And then when they prescribe it, we need to have it monitored appropriately for the correct duration. And all of the adjunctive care is the mental health assessments, the psychosocial assessments, the medical assessments, and to try and tie this all in together for more people out there than fit the current treatment slots is very difficult. So I can tell you, I'm medical director at Huther Doyle as well, and I see people come in and stabilized after detox on buprenorphine, and when monitored and when taking it appropriately, they can do fantastic. And I followed a group of patients long-term that continue into the toxicology clinic over at Strong, and they've been sober for years and doing quite well. I also see people that struggle, and sometimes they struggle several times, and then the fourth, fifth, sixth time they get into treatment, they start to do well. So it's having a system that adapts to the individual needs. Medications are a part of it, but not just part of it. We need the psychosocial and the mental health and the medical as well.
But Dr. Wiegand, are you saying that you the drug that you mentioned, the
buprenorphine or Suboxone,
Are we short on treatment slots, or do we need more resources to handle treatment? I'm trying to make sure I understand exactly what you're saying. Because you seem to be saying when we get people in for treatment, it can work.
Buprenorphine was made available in 2002 as a office-based opiate treatment. Physicians had to become certified, which created a mystique and a black box around it. And a lot of physicians, once they found out they had to get an extra certification to prescribe it, they became a little bit uneasy about prescribing it. Before 2002, methadone was your only option, really. And in a methadone clinic, I'm sure people have images and things that methadone clinic has a lot of baggage in terms of what it brings to people's mind. There's incredible stigma associated with it. It does work, but buprenorphine in 2002 took what was only relegated to a clinic into an office-based setting. So the physicians have been relatively slow to adapt to this. There are in Rochester more physicians than other places, I think, around the state and in other states in the country. But we still, compared to the number of people that would qualify for buprenorphine, we're still short on slots. Most providers have a waiting list. Most programs have a waiting list. In fact, not even all programs that are offering treatment have a buprenorphine provider available.
How are we going to change that?
Well, so addiction is a disease that belongs in the primary care physician's office. It's a chronic relapsing condition, just like diabetes. It has individual genetic, environmental factors. All of these variables are the same types of variables that go into how bad someone's diabetes or how bad someone's hypertension might be. We have 10 to 20% of individuals that have substance use disorders. It should be in the primary care clinician's office that they identify this, that they're comfortable with making the referrals, and then also comfortable taking the first steps to stabilize somebody or to pick them up from a treatment program. I've got a number of people that are on Suboxone that I can't find places for that have stable primary care physicians just because their primary care physician doesn't want to create or take the certification for their X waiver and create opportunities in their clinic when these are chronic stable patients. I think it's a complicated answer, but and there are a lot of different moving parts to the solution, but some of it would be to have the primary care physicians acknowledge that they can do this in the office.
Okay. Alinda, did you want to jump in? You were kind of reacting to some of that conversation as well. What do you think?
No, I agree with Dr. Wiegand. I think that part of the barriers to people being able to get into treatment are the lack of beds. The insurance will only cover so much. Sometimes the insurance doesn't even cover inpatient. So I think some of the things we need to work on are getting the insurance companies to cover more types, a broader range of the insurance. I think that we also need to look at the waiting times. I know for our particular participants, where we're dealing with active users who come in and they say, I need to get into treatment right away. We call, we'll do a phone screen if we need to. We fill out the forms, we send them in. Then they say, oh, well, call us back every day or every 3 days. And they could be calling back 3-4 weeks, if not a couple months, waiting for beds to get in to either detox, inpatient, and sometimes waiting to get into either methadone or Suboxone is definitely months. And we lose a lot of our folks who are ready at that point to get in because they wait so long, then they're back out.
Okay. And then the other point that he was making, and I don't know if our panelists can speak to this, he's saying he actually asked his doctor, don't give me so much hydrocodone. I don't need that much. Why am I getting 40 pills when I want 6? Does that happen, Dr. Wiegand?
Well, that was an excellent point. Pain is a difficult and nebulous kind of variable. There's a lot of our population's growing older. There's more people that have conditions that have some pain associated with them. And the quick fix for pain is usually to give a medication, an opioid. They're great at relieving pain, but they have a lot of problems associated with them. They're great for acute pain, for the type of pain that the question was, I think, after a surgery. So they're great for post-operative pain, but for a very brief time period, because after that you start to deal with the side effects, and in fact, they have diminishing return on their pain. Most people, though, have difficulty accessing the other resources for pain, physical therapy, lifestyle modifications. These things take time, and it's easier to take a medication. I think physicians also, it's easier to prescribe a number of medications and then hope that, well, this will cover them through the weekend, this will cover them through Monday, do Tuesday through Wednesday, and won't have to deal with the requests coming back. If I prescribe 40 of them, I won't have to field a call until next week potentially. But they're exactly right that we overprescribe prescription opioids. If we give people prescription opioids, a certain percentage of them are going to have a problem with them. We know that, and we see that with the rising rates of addiction, they parallel the rising rates of prescription.
Do we know how much, by the way, Dr. Wiegand? I mean, do we know what percentage of the population might have an addictive response to opioids? We don't know.
It's hard to say exactly, and it depends on what population you look at. Between 10 and 20% of individuals will have a lifetime prevalence of substance use disorder.
Wow. I mean, remember last hour, Sam Quiñones, the journalist, reminded us that when OxyContin hit the market, the initial ostensible studies, which were discredited, told us fewer than 1%.
Right.
10 to 20 is what we're hearing. I'm way late for a break and the phones are flooded, but I want to let Robert just pop back in to make any other final points, Robert?
Sure. I think the biggest takeaway I got from your guest's response was I didn't hear a number. I heard a lot of if all the stars align, yes, they stay on their meds. If they get mental health care, if they receive this breaking drug, if all these things happen, we have a success or what have you. But I will tell you, I'll take the word of the sheriff, drug task force officer who offered the free drug dogs, who was absolutely alarmed. And he said it's in every school. It's in private and parochial, from McQuaid to Mercy to Pittsford to Fairfort to East Rochester. He says, don't make any mistake. It's not just people have these misconceptions. And to sit there and deny it. And like I say, he's giving these parents a false idea of how serious it is because he can give me the, I'd like to hear his actual percentage of total success rate because the sheriff told me it's abysmal, like 10%. And he said to them verbatim, if they get on it 3, 4, 5 times to try it, the only place you're going to end up is in a box. He said if his daughter, this is a quote, if his daughter tried heroin and got hooked on it, he said his only option would be to quit his job and lock her in the basement and wash her 24 hours a day to save her life. He said you can't imagine, he said, how absolutely horrible the success rate of getting these people off the drug is. And if you listen to your guest closely, there's a lot of couching in the answers. And the truth is what parents should be hearing.
All right, Robert, thanks for the phone call. Dr. Wiegand wanted to respond.
Well, I can give you an example from one population that has the right treatment that lines up for them. That's physicians or other healthcare professionals. When you identify a physician, for example, with a substance use disorder, and they are under a program of monitoring for 5 years, the success is above 90%. That's because they get the attention that they need, the medications that they need, the monitoring that they need, the psychosocial, all of this is a complete package. What I'm saying is we don't have the complete package for the rest of society, and we should because the success rates are very high when you offer the complete package.
And before we take a break, I want to remind our listeners, this is a whole month series that we are doing, and you'll hear it in this conversation, and you'll definitely hear it in some of my reports in the coming weeks. We have a shortage of doctors that are trained in how to deal with addiction medications, so addiction medicine. So that's one of the problems. We mentioned right now there's a shortage of beds. There's long waiting lists. It's difficult to pay for the treatment. There are problems and barriers to getting your insurance to pay for this treatment. So, I mean, we're dealing with many barriers that are getting people to care. So that is one of the main reasons why there's a large failure rate, because a person may be trying to get treatment but is not able to access that. And we'll be looking at that throughout the month, and we'll be following it very closely as well as during this hour.
And to Robert's point, I don't think anyone doubts that if you hit a barrier and you don't get past it and you're addicted to heroin or you have an opioid problem, you're in trouble. But what Dr. Wiegand is saying is it's worth all of us looking at the landscape and trying to make sure anyone we know who needs the help gets there, because if they get it, there is a good success rate. Good points on all counts. Back to your phone calls after this short break as we continue our discussion on heroin and opioid addiction. Our guests for the hour, my colleague Michelle Faust, who's done such great work on this subject, is helping co-host the program. Olinda Ford and Heather White are here from Trillium, and Dr. Timothy Wiegand is here, the Director of Toxicology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Right back with your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we'll talk to a retired member of law enforcement with years of experience in counterterrorism and related matters. We'll talk about the danger in too quickly assigning motives to mass shooters. We'll also talk about the expertise required in the recent police manhunt for the escaped murderers. And then we'll talk about raising the age of responsibility and criminality in New York. Talk to you Tuesday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Village at Unity, independent senior living that supports an active, independent lifestyle, offering hospitality, personal transportation, and other amenities. The Village at Unity, like no other. For tours, call 723-7442. And Friedmaxic CPAs, an audit, tax, and consulting firm working to meet the dynamic needs of local businesses. Services available in Rochester, friedmaxic.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. When I say Trillium, I use the shorthand. I'm a little bit sloppy of the host. It's Trillium Health, and that's important. And Trillium Health is online. Online where, Olinda?
At trilliumhealth.org. Mm-hmm. You can get our website there.
And we've had a lot of conversations this month coming up with Trillium Health from a number of angles. But Michelle Faust, before we jump back to the phones, which we'll do in just a moment, you want to hit one other important point here.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to hear a little bit more from Heather. You're dealing with people who are coming in, they're in active addiction. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that they're saying that are their barriers to getting treatment? I mean, we talked about barriers to treatment. We'll be talking about that all month. But what are you hearing?
I usually get a referral from Olinda from the Outreach Project, and what's nice about that is they bring the patient at that time while they have them, while they're ready. Some of them know they have Hep C, some of them don't. They bring them to the clinic. I see them right away that day, so there's no barrier as far as scheduling an appointment and having to come back 2 weeks later. Then I get them hopefully primary care with us. A lot of them don't have primary care. We also have mental health and substance abuse counselors and case managers who would help overcome barriers such as rides to their medical appointments. I do feel like a lot of the patients that I see want to come off heroin. All of the things that we've talked about are reasons why they can't, but they can't do it because of their withdrawal. And so they're stuck in this cycle while they're waiting to get into treatment.
And what does withdrawal look like? I mean, for people who are hearing the word heroin, what do they know? They know what they've seen in the media, what they've seen in films. But I don't think that the typical person who hasn't been exposed to it really knows what that means.
It's very painful, abdominal pain, diarrhea, sweating, insomnia. I don't know if you can chime in on that.
Yeah, those are the main symptoms that, you know, people come and talk to us about. Not being able to sleep, the abdominal, the aches, you know, it's like their bones ache, things like that that they go through, and it can be very intense.
Michelle, I didn't mean to jump in there. Go ahead.
Dr. Wiegand, can a person die from that
withdrawal? I know people say that they feel they're going to, but is it possible to die from a heroin withdrawal?
Heroin withdrawal or opiate withdrawal is not life-threatening. And people compare the symptoms oftentimes to a cold or flu, but what people are often forgetting is the craving and this anxiety that people have, that they will sit in the emergency department for 12 hours to get a dose of Dilaudid or a prescription, a short prescription for medications, and misrepresent their medical condition, their symptoms, and face discrimination and potential discharge from the emergency department. People, you were talking about drug court earlier. A lot of the patients that I have that have gone through drug court are there for petty larceny. You don't go into Wegmans and steal, or any convenience store, and steal something to fix your cold and flu symptoms, but people do, and to try and self-treat their withdrawal. That's the addiction part of it. It's certainly more than just the physical symptoms. It's the mental and the craving and the anxiety as well.
We're going to get through as many phone calls as we can through the rest of the hour. So if we come to you, let's try to keep it moving. Charlotte in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Charlotte.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I have a 24-year-old sister who currently incarcerated. She's been going through just back and forth with heroin addiction for 7 years now. The underlying problem has always been her depression and anxiety. She's been suicidal and things, and then when that happens, she'll, turn to the self-medication piece, and it's just got to be so bad that it's turned into, being arrested for possession and things like that. And so I'm wondering why there's such a disconnect between piecing together a program that would offer mental health as well as addiction treatment. Because for someone like her, until she's emotionally healthy, she will turn to heroin. So it seems like just rehab is not enough.
Charlotte, thanks for the phone call. And not an easy question to answer, but Olinda, can we start with you?
I think part of the issue is, I know I spent many years in the addiction field, and one of the issues that I came up with is that a lot of times, in order for a mental health provider to accept a patient, they need to have clean time. And it's very hard sometimes to have that clean time before they start into the mental health. And it would help if they could work through that with the mental health provider.
Dr. Wiegand?
There's also a shortage of mental health providers as well, from psychiatrists to clinical psychologists. The addiction programs, the treatment programs, will refer people for mental health assessment and to see an advanced provider or physician, but oftentimes they have to make a certain number of appointments to make sure that they're committed to actually attending the appointment, which gets to your comment about which came first. The mental health and stabilizing somebody on mental health is critically important to get their addiction under control. And stabilizing the addiction is critical to get their mental health under control. So there's a couple of programs that are starting to look at integrating the both of them, but it gets back to a number of providers. There's a limited availability of time and just simply presence for the mental health field as well.
Charlotte, any follow-up from you?
We continue to, as a family, look for different options for her, but it just seems like at this point, once she gets the addiction under control and has been clean, it's just that mental health piece rises up, and she just doesn't have the skill set to really advocate for herself and commit herself to care. She's 24. She started when she was an 18-year-old in high school, and it's just such a sad, terrible situation when you have someone who's starting the independent years of their lives and they don't have that support. And and she's past 18 years old, she's technically an adult, so there's no way as a family member that we could force her into any treatment, which I don't think you ever want to force someone, because they're not in it for themselves. But it's just, as a family, we feel like we're kind of on our own, and we're just waiting for a terrible phone call at this point. So kind of this feeling of helplessness, especially with someone so young, and it's been very frustrating.
Charlotte, I appreciate you sharing that. Dr. Wiegand, you want to? Thank you, Charlotte. Go ahead, Dr. Wiegand.
I hear a lot of these comments from other family members as well, and I like to recommend that the families attend Al-Anon or Narcanon, just to realize that they're not the only ones going through this at all, and a lot of other family members can help people navigate the system, can provide some information about typical programs, certain pathway about, and just be there as a resource for them. People can get lists of the Narcanon and Al-Anon meetings, and there's also programs that have family meetings that can meet with the individual and family to help them go get through this.
Linda Ford?
Okay, there's also recently developed it sometime last year, so there's the Family Recovery Network that was developed by a group of parents to help and support, and they also do programs to educate and stuff, and you can find them online, and they're there to support, particularly family, friends of people who have addiction issues, and many of them are dealing with the heroin opioid issue.
All right, let me go to Geneseo, and this is Linda. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
There's a lot to say. I'll try not to overload it. One thing that you mentioned about insurance and, about heroin addiction and withdrawal not causing death, that was actually a reason that our son's claim, when we were told by the insurance company when he went in for a detox, that they, after he was already in, they were going to kick him out after 3 days because insurance wouldn't pay for it, because withdrawal will not kill you. DTs from alcohol will, so they'll pay for that, but they won't from heroin. And so even with 3 letters of support that they demanded from doctors saying that our son might actually die from it because of other problems, they turned us down. So that was an interesting thing to note. The other thing is that when I love the idea of drug court. That's nice. It's Monroe County. We're in Livingston County. That was not an option for my son for one of the many times he's gone through the system. So he went to a shock camp treatment at Willard and then was released to a homeless shelter where all around him was people offering him stuff. And so things didn't go well. He's incarcerated again now. And calling saying, Mom, I couldn't stay clean. I just couldn't. The other thing you brought up, which was a good thing to have, bring people's minds to, is that these folks are dual diagnosis, the drug addiction and the mental illness concurrent, and which came first. Hard to say. I think in my son's case, definitely mental illness, but they don't have the wherewithal to follow through with all the things afterwards. It's absolutely true. And if you're following Narcanon and Al-Anon, which is, you know, tough love and give them support, but don't get too involved, don't get enmeshed, they can't do a lot of things on their own. Their brains are compromised. And so that's a very tricky water to try to navigate as a parent of an addict, that you don't want to get too involved, that you have to do something because the systems aren't in place. And my last little mini rant is about Suboxone. I'm sorry. I think it's a racket. I hope somebody will do an investigative report. I don't like it. It's black marketed. They're cutting programs in kicking people out of 30-day programs or even stopping 30-day programs and releasing them with Suboxone. I know from my son's experience and a lot of his friends, they can toggle back and forth between using it and using heroin. And I know you said, yes, if there's stricter use, then they're done exactly right, but they're not. They're just not. And I wish I could end on a happy note. My son's 25. I don't know if he'll make it to 30. Of course, we hope he will with all our hearts because we love him. But the situation isn't good. It's like this is a new scourge that is somehow, we're just losing them right and left. And unless more money is given to the system on a federal level, state by state only have so much. And New York is one of the best in terms of social services. I know that from my mother-in-law, I know it from my son. But we need more federal involvement as well, because all of your comments from all of you have been so wonderful. And almost every one of us says we don't have enough doctors for Suboxone, which is a racket anyway, but it would be maybe less of a racket if it didn't have to be just a few people prescribing it. There's less programs. They're being shut down. My son has tried to get himself in when he's relapsed, and there hasn't been enough time for him to be scooped up by that, and so he gets arrested instead. And that actually is his way of not dying. It's showing up to parole screwed up so that they'll put him in jail so that maybe he can live another 2 months till they release him again. I'm sorry, that was so long-winded, but I'll get off.
Linda, please, actually, if you can hold the line, what I'd like to do is I'd like you to hang in there, because you gave us a lot, and I really admire you as a parent and as someone willing to share the story. I know it's been difficult, so hang in there. I'm going to put you back on hold, and I want our guests to respond to a number of different things. Dr. Wiegand, you immediately wanted to respond to her first comment there. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the comments about the withdrawal, and withdrawal physically is not going to kill somebody, but the listener is absolutely correct that the lifestyle does kill people. Or they end up incarcerated and with an awful lot of baggage in their personal life and their family's life. So with the withdrawal, the physical withdrawal is part of it. It's the relapse and the risk for overdose when people are in and out of treatment, that there certainly is a lethality associated with opioid dependence and heroin dependence.
Okay. When it comes to Suboxone, she had some very harsh words for it. Olinda, that's come up again. You know, for our listeners who are not all that familiar with Suboxone, maybe let's first define what that is and let's talk a little bit about it. Suboxone?
I'm not real familiar with Suboxone. I know that it's an antagonist.
Suboxone's a trade name. It's like calling Tylenol acetaminophen. It's buprenorphine, naloxone, mm-hmm. and the 4-to-1 ratio. It's a particular product. There's several other products. There's Bunavail, there's Zubsolve, there's generic buprenorphine, there was Subutex. So buprenorphine is an opioid, but it's only what's called a partial agonist, meaning it only partially activates the receptors that heroin acts at, or methadone or oxycodone. When an addict or somebody that's dependent on an opioid gets it, it stabilizes their system and takes away the craving and their withdrawal, but it doesn't get them high. It doesn't get them high, and they can continue this medication and take it regularly, just like a diabetic might take insulin to kind of stabilize their disease. And the listener brought up several important comments about buprenorphine. There's so many people that are opioid dependent and in withdrawal and craving each day that there's an incredible black market for the medications that are used to treat the withdrawal and craving, whether it's methadone or whether it's Suboxone. In fact, when I give a prescription to somebody for Suboxone, it's like giving them a voucher, and the voucher says you can take this as a coupon to stay sober, or you can take this to trade it for other drugs or for other cash. And if not monitored appropriately and people don't learn the cognitive behavioral skills and have the structure to their lives, that temptation to divert, to sell it for other chemicals is incredibly great.
She said that she views it as a way to toggle back and forth between full heroin use and Suboxone, and that she called it a racket. What did you think?
Well, I think if it's not monitored appropriately, it definitely can be a racket, but if it's monitored appropriately, it can save people's lives. It can prevent somebody from being incarcerated. It can save their life and completely turn somebody around.
You've seen that.
I've seen that. I have many patients that are stable and sober for years, and I've seen people's lives completely turned around. I've also seen people get a prescription for Suboxone, leave the office, and then go sell it or trade it for medications, and then come back the next week and try to get back on the program and do the same thing over and over again. I see people come through detoxes and without the correct monitoring, without the correct support system, it's very difficult for people to get on track. But some of them do, and I think trying to adapt, we have other medications. We have naltrexone. We don't have enough Suboxone providers. We don't have enough naltrexone providers. Naltrexone is an antagonist, meaning it only blocks the receptor. Some people that have struggled with Suboxone, for example, with diverting it, with selling it, but are still opioid dependent, could get onto naltrexone, and that prevents them from overdosing. It blocks euphoria, it blocks a respiratory depression, it would keep them alive. It doesn't take care of pain, for example, but a lot of people would do fine with it, a young, healthy 20, 30-year-old.
Olinda?
One of the things that Trillium Health, we provide at our outreach project, is we do opioid overdose prevention training and provide the naloxone. And while we're waiting for there to become more treatment, you know, agencies available, more beds available, one of the best things that I recommend to the families and friends is to be trained in opioid prevention and to get the naloxone. At least in that way, you're going to be able to help your loved one or someone you may know not have a fatal overdose.
And having that training, I mean, that's one of the conversations that I had with the toxicologist here from Monroe County, looking at people who are who are dying of overdoses. Really, her point is that people need to have access to people who are actually using need to have mm-hmm. access and be trained in naloxone. And that's one of the things that you offer to the people who are in your clinic. And we're going to hear from Dr. Bino.
71% of the victims of heroin overdose were dead at the scene, wherever that might, whether it's home or they're using it at a drug house or wherever. So they're dead at the scene. So what I can say is that if naloxone is really going to be effective, and I know some of the programs are doing this, it has to be pushed out to the actual users themselves and their families. Because by the time you have police or other emergency responders there, they're already dead. It's too late.
That's Dr. Jean Bino, and So let me just cycle back to Linda. I know you may have some disagreement or your personal experience with your family has been tough on this, but some final thoughts before we close, start to close the hour, Linda.
For me, it's very hard to have hope. I know it would be great to be able to end this on this wonderful Disney note, like, and then they found Suboxone, or then they got the treatment they needed, but honestly, I don't see it, and I'm a mother of an addict, and we've been going through this a long time, and I want to have hope, but it's very, very difficult. I don't know if there's an answer. I appreciate the fact that so many people are trying to find answers, but the whole idea of, like, halfway houses, supported living after jail time for these nonviolent offenders would be extremely helpful, but that's not always the way it happens. It's up to the parole folks, it's up to other people. And sometimes I never say that my kid's a victim of the system, because I believe that there was agency in all of his choices. But I do think there are things along the way that make it very difficult and don't necessarily help. But I don't have any answers. I'm just trying to be involved and uninvolved mom, and hope to not get that phone call that Charlotte mentioned before. But thank you very much for taking the call. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Linda. Some final thoughts then. Heather White, you wanted to jump in.
Yes, I just wanted to mention to Linda that she mentioned the lack of resources at Trillium Health. We have insurance specialists that will get you on the insurance that would be needed, the case management, mental health, substance abuse. We refer to Huther Doyle. And it's one-stop shop, and that's the beauty of it, because I think having to go to all these appointments across Rochester, mm-hmm. it's setting them up for failure. So there are some resources.
Well, I wish, again, Linda could leave the hour with more optimism and hope, but I understand the sentiment. I also appreciate the expertise from our panelists this hour in helping us navigate this growing problem that hopefully, hopefully 3 to 5 to 10 years from now, we're talking about a different story. But Heather White, you just heard, is an RN at Trillium Health. Thank you for being here. Alinda Ford is the manager of the Harm Reduction Initiative at Trillium Health. Thank you, Alinda.
Thank you.
Dr. Tim Wiegand is the Director of Toxicology for the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Wiegand, thank you.
Thank you.
And Michelle Faust has been doing tremendous work in this subject matter. Online, we're continuing with the subject.
That's right. All month long, WXXINews.org. Click on Heroin at Home. We'll be talking about many different parts of this larger problem. And we could have taken 3 hours today.
There's no question. I mean, that's just remarkable. Thank you, Michelle. Nice working with you on this.
Thank you.
Thanks to the excellent team engineering the program. And I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening to Member Supported Public Radio.